Live presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
Now here's your host, Andrew Longhurst.
Good evening. We'll be speaking today with Isabel Ferreras of the AMS about the upcoming student elections. In national news, our own CITR station manager, Brenda Gruno, speaks to us about the current CRTC hearings, which will affect community and campus stations across the country. In international news, we will speak to the Canadian Red Cross about the ongoing relief efforts and particularly how residents in the Lower Mainland have responded to the disaster in Haiti. In regional news, we bring you a special feature about how the BC government's Gateway Project will affect the fragile Burns Bog in Delta, BC. Finally, we bring you coverage of the Greenpeace protests that occurred during Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff's visit to the UBC campus. We'll have all this, plus your arts report and your weekday weather forecast, coming up this hour right here on News 101. First, we want to tell you about a new segment that we'll start on News 101 beginning during the Olympics. CITR News is committed to providing you with in-depth Olympic coverage from an alternative perspective. As part of the coverage, we are launching a new Eyes on the Street feature, where Vancouverites will have a chance to tell their Olympic story. We want to hear your perspective on life in Vancouver during the Games. Be CITR's Eyes on the Streets this February. If you're at an event, a protest, a celebration, or even simply on the bus, tell us about it. There are three ways to file a report. Call our Eyes on the Street hotline at 604-822-5334 or email news at citr.ca, or you can tweet us at CITR News. Then sit back and wait for your report to be featured on the next edition of News 101, which airs Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. It's now time for some public service announcements, but stay tuned for more national and local news. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
It's been so long, we're glad we came before. We got the fame or had a name, a story hasn't changed. With accolades, we're still standing, and we'll be back again. It's been so long.
Australian hip-hop group The Hilltop Hoods have already dominated Down Under, and now they're looking to do the same here in Canada. Catch The Hilltop Hoods February 10th at Venue in Vancouver.
The tour, in support of their platinum album State of the Art, will be their first headlining tour in Canada. See The Hilltop Hoods up close and personal before they graduate to stadium shows.
Tickets are going fast, so get yours sooner than later. Tickets available now at Ticketmaster, Livestock, and Zulu.
The Hilltop Hoods at Venue in Vancouver, February 10th. Don't miss it.
UBC Rec is everything that is recreation on campus. No matter how you play, UBC Rec is your resource for fun activities. This student program is operated by over 140 volunteers, and it is the largest intramural recreation organization in Canada. Programs cover fitness, instructional classes, outdoor recreation, drop-in sports, special events, small tournaments, and intramural leagues. All the registration information is available in the Student Recreation Center or online at rec.ubc.ca. UBC Rec, how do you play?
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Turner, and you're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. The AMS student elections are almost upon us. Isabel Ferraris is here to speak with us about the upcoming elections. She is the AMS elections coordinator. Isabel, you've implemented a number of rule changes this year. Please explain to our listeners the penalty box, your new chalking rules, and the shortened campaign period, and what led you to implement these changes.
All right, so I'll start with chalking. The whole idea behind chalking is quite simple. We know that it was a very effective campaign procedure that they used last year, and it was very visible to all students. But what we did see was that a lot of chalk was going onto walls all over the campus, and many people complained to the elections about it, stating that it was basically a form of graffiti. So we decided to remove that. The ability to candidates to chalk on walls. So they're only allowed to chalk on the ground, and that's that. And it's going to be a lot less vandalizing, we think. The penalty box was actually suggested by my chief returning officer. His name's Ricardo Bertolon. And the idea behind that, we actually took it from the science elections that they had in the beginning of the year, where they listed all the penalties that the candidates were subject to. But this was including warnings and suspension of campaigning privileges and everything. But the whole idea behind it is that students actually know what candidates are up to, not just talking about their platform, but talking about, seeing if they are, if they're willing enough to follow the rules and run an effective campaign despite that. So it's just basically to add a little more accountability to the candidates and give people a chance to follow the rules. It will provide a lot of less stress for us. And then finally, the shortened campaign period is also a simple solution to a problem we had last year, which is students that were campaigning took a lot of time out of school. 3 weeks out of school is a long time for a student. Second of all, it was actually in violation of our bylaws under the AMS, which stated that elections had to be held by the end of January. And they ran into February last year, and we couldn't accept that. And thirdly, we had a large gap between nomination forms being handed in and the actual start of campaign period, because candidates need time to prepare, and again, they have a lot going on. They have a lot of school going on. So it was just sort of a provision we made. So,
did any UBC administrators complain to you about chalking on campus?
Yes, they did.
So of the changes that you've implemented, and you've implemented more than the three that we just spoke about, are there any that you'll recommend to next year's AMS elections coordinator that he or she does not use again?
Well, it's hard to say since campaigning just started, but I would say, I guess that shortening the period between nominations closing and campaigning starting could be a little shorter, like 5 days or something like that, just because it allows more media coverage, but it still strikes a fine balance. So that's what I would say.
And lastly, I know you're coordinating some debates. Can you tell us when the debates are and the structure, the format of the debates?
Yes, the debates are going to be a sort of differing structure because we have so many candidates. We currently have 12 Senate candidates, so we'll be having a debate specifically for them tomorrow, actually, and it's going to be in the sub-conversation pit. And that will be at 12:30.
So. Do they each get one question?
Essentially, they're going to be given a chance, 30 seconds, to introduce themselves, and then they'll be given questions mostly directed from the audience. We're going to make it more of a bigger forum rather than formalization because there's so many candidates. We have to make some provisions for that. But we'll have more structure for our president and VPX and VP Finance and VP Admin and Board of Governors debates. So those will be on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and then on Monday as well.
Will there be any head-to-head where candidates can argue with each other or respond?
Yes, we're going to allow that. We're going to limit how much candidates can do that because there's only so much time we have. There's an hour and a half maximum for debates. But given that, we think it's a useful use of our time. So,
thank you very much, Isabel. We're going to take a quick break. But stay tuned. Up next, we're bringing you an interview with CITR station manager Brenda Guaranu about the CRTC hearings, which will affect the community and campus radio stations across the country. Brad Pepin-Nix spoke with Brenda Grunau earlier today.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer, back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Maybe a song from a film or a tune from TV? Radio Free GAC brings you sounds of the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future and the forgotten classics that need a little rescue. Radio Free GAC, Monday evening, 7:30 till 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Want to know what's going on around town? LiveMusicVancouver.com is the Lower Mainland's comprehensive source for live music listings. We've got more than 350 shows listed at any time, and our listings are updated continuously by hundreds of the very people who put on the shows you love. Artist information and MP3s are accessible right from the listings, as are maps and calendars for virtually every venue in the city. All this and tons more totally free at LiveMusicVancouver.com.
Remember when you first learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website, www.spec.bc.ca, for more information.
Walking alone at night can be scary!
Stop right there, student. Why walk alone when you can call Safe Walk? The safety and comfort of everyone on campus is important. That's why we're here.
SafeWalk is a free, student-run foot patrol service with two-person co-ed teams that will meet you and accompany you anywhere on campus to make sure you get there safely.
Keep an eye out for our bright red reflective jackets and signature foot logo, and let your next walk be with us.
What a huge relief! Now I'll never have to worry about the terrors that could happen when walking through such a big campus at night.
For a walk, you can call 604-822-5355, use one of our direct line phones located in some of the campus libraries, use one of the big blue phone booths, or even ask campus security to contact us.
If you see walkers around campus and you'd like them to accompany you, stop and ask.
Welcome back to CITR. This is... It's 5:18 right now. This is News 101, and the current time is 5:18. CRTC hearings are underway in Gatineau right now, and they will have a significant impact on campus and community radio in Canada. CITR station manager Brenda Grunau is one of the presenters to the CRTC. She spoke with Brad Pepin-Nix earlier today about the hearings and the future of campus and community radio in Canada. Here's what she had to say.
In studio right now with Brenda Grunau, and Brenda is the station manager here at CITR. And Brenda, I was hoping that you could give us a little context about these upcoming CRTC proceedings that are taking place in Gatineau, Quebec, as of tomorrow morning.
Sure. The hearing actually started today, and you can listen to the whole thing on the CRTC website. So for 4 days, people have the opportunity to present what they submitted in a written submission. Basically, they're reviewing the campus and community radio policy. So they had an open call for submissions, and you could write what you said, what you thought about the current policy and different challenges the sector has. And this is our opportunity, whoever requested it, to present and then field questions by the commissioners.
And so, as we've discussed, or as you've made mention to, the CRTC is this government body that regulates the happenings of all types of media in Canada. So it's not only television and print, but it's also radio. So this is radio's opportunity to make sure that what's going on is up to date. Could you maybe tell us, the last proceedings were actually in 1999. So in terms of what's going on now, is it kind of just catching up to what's going on?
Yeah, they basically, every decade, they take a look and say, you know, under the current structure of how we regulate, is this working and is it effective? Is it satisfying the goals that we think the industry has? Are these rules actually slowing down the people affected by it, or are they a helpful tool for regulating?
Right. And so, as our trusty listeners will probably know, CITR is part of the NCRA, which is the National Campus Radio Association.
Yeah, National Campus and Community Radio Association.
And so, as a member of the NCRA, we have contributed to what the NCRA is presenting to the CRTC. Maybe you could just sum up what the NCRA is hoping that these proceedings will kind of deliver with CRTC.
Sure. We have a whole bunch of things and a whole bunch of topics. And when the commission sent out their call for submissions, they actually had a huge list of very specific questions asking sort of, does this work for you and how would you change it? So they're really looking for specific recommendations on what they can do to improve. So they don't want to hear people just complain. They want specific recommendations. So the NCRA pulled all the NCRA member stations and did up a massive document about where we think things should go in the sector. So there's a bunch of sort of hot topics. As a part of this, one of them is funding. So they're advocating for a chunk of the Canadian Content Development, the CCD money, that every time a commercial station gets a license, they have to put towards a certain portion of money towards benefiting the community. And our sector is arguing that we should have a part of that money. Some of that money goes to Factor, and some of it currently goes to whatever projects they choose. So, for example, when The Peak came out, they chose to do a partnership with, I think it's the Rogue Folk Club. No, the Vancouver Folk Music Festival. And The Shore has partnered with the Rogue Folk Club. So you can see these partnerships are partly sort of suiting their marketing purposes, but they're also different ways of engaging the community. So we've asked for help accessing some of that money because the sector as a whole is really underfunded, and they did a study and found out that the average salary is actually $27,000 in the radio sector, and we all know that's not very much.
And so you are actually going to be participating in this conference tomorrow via video, I guess, messaging. So I was wondering, is this something that you are going to be addressing? Is that the funding, or are there other concerns that you, as a representative of CITR, are going to be bringing up?
I'm going to talk, yes, a bit. I have a page of notes about funding and how campus and community radio stations don't really fit into any funding program. So our options for accessing public dollars are very slim. We don't have charitable status or associated with the university, which dramatically cuts down our chances, and we don't really fit into the other programs that Heritage Canada has. Basically, the only thing we can access are employment programs that help us employ staff. Another area that the CRTC was asking about is new media. Sort of questions like, well, if you can stream online, do you need to have an FM license? Or how does new technology affect your station? And things like that, you know, maintaining our computer systems and broadcasting online, we're super reliant on volunteers, and we can't keep up because for smaller stations, it's more of an issue of we can't afford that $1,000 server. For stations like us, it's like, what if our podcasting goes down and our very, very part-time staff person isn't around to fix it, and our part-time volunteer, you know, isn't there either. So it could take us, you know, 3 to 5 days to solve a problem when this is sort of a basic technical service that any commercial station would have full-time people on retainer doing these kind of things.
Right. And so if not only these issues are things that our listeners are interested in, but also if, you know, people are just more interested in CITR and making sure that CITR can continue to do the great things that it's doing or make sure that those things even get better, what could they do? How can they be involved in the CRTC proceedings?
Well, at an earlier point, that people could have submitted their own comments. So when there was a call for submissions, if you were an individual that felt very passionate about these things, you could totally have had made your own submission. And then once you make your submission, you can request to present or not present. Mm-hmm. Then you're either invited to or not. So I think the main thing right now is to become aware of the issues in the sector and take those opportunities to lobby. You could write letters to the CRTC and kind of stuff, but this is the formal process for them collecting information.
And so our listeners can tune into the CRTC website to check out the proceedings?
Yeah, that's a very cool thing. You just go on the CRTC website and listen in online, and you can hear all the presentations. And I'll be presenting tomorrow, probably late morning or early afternoon. And just wanted to add, too, that the larger stations are also advocating on the issue of spectrum scarcity. So the CRTC has been selling off the frequencies to a lot of commercial stations, and in some populations or communities, there isn't even a frequency available if someone wanted to start a community station. So we've been arguing quite strongly that every community in Canada, since community radio is the third sector of broadcasting, that every community should have the access to participate in their local media and have a local community station. And so even if no one decides to do this for, say, 100 years, we've asked them to reserve a frequency in each community wherever possible, since obviously it's too late in a lot of places, but so that if the public decides they want to have a station that they govern and participate in and use to create local content, that they have that opportunity.
Great. Well, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay. Thanks, Brad.
Thanks to reporter Brad Pepik for that coverage. We turn now to our weather specialist Dan Casanova for our weekday weather forecast. Dan, what's in store for us this week?
Hey, Ian. Here's our weekday weather forecast for January 18th to the 22nd. Today, we experienced high wind gusts early in the morning due to a low pressure system that passed right next to Vancouver. It will continue to be windy late tonight and tomorrow morning. There will be a decreasing temperature trend throughout the week, but not cold enough yet for snow. Monday evening to the overnight, 40% chance of rain, becoming windy near midnight, low of 6 degrees. For Tuesday, rain with windy periods in the morning, high of 9 degrees, low of 7. Wednesday, we'll see isolated showers with a high of 10 degrees and a low of 7. For Thursday, periods of rain, high of 8 degrees, low of 4. And for Friday, there's going to be a 70% chance of showers with a high of 7 degrees and a low of 3. Currently, it is partly cloudy and 9 degrees at YVR. That's your weekend weather, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
Thanks to Dan and the UBC Storm Club for that coverage. In provincial news, the Burns Bog is a very sensitive ecological area in Delta BC, but the BC government's Gateway Project will significantly affect the fragile ecosystem. We bring you a special feature by Lisa Rodina about the Burns Bog.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 Vancouver. My name is Lucy, and I would like to tell you a story. It is a part of a community service learning project that I'm doing through my political theory and non-human life class here at UBC. The interesting thing about this story is that, in fact, it's not a single story, but rather a compound of multiple stories through which one can hear a variety of different voices. Some of them loud and dominant, and others quieter, marginalized, or silenced. They will essentially talk about the Gateway Delta Port Expansion Project and its impact on the local and global environment. Firstly, there is the story of TSI Terminal System, part of which is Vancouver's Delta Port. Delta Port is the largest container terminal in Canada, handling approximately 70% of the containerized cargo that moves through Port Metro Vancouver. This story goes like this. Delta Port is the largest container facility in Canada. The expansion of the port will build an additional berth number 3, which will increase the rail handling capacity of the port from 60,000 feet to 74,000 feet per day. Cranes capable of hosting dual 40 feet or quadruple 20 feet per single lift will be brought into the facility. TSI, this will become the first terminal in North America to possess cranes with this handling capacity. The expansion project will increase vessel productivity. Here is a quote from the TSI brochure. Expansion is one of our investments designed to meet the growth needs of customers and to firmly place them in a position of market strength and longevity. This development strategy is labeled Global Business, Local Interests. Then there is this other story. Supported by local activist community groups such as the Wilderness Committee and the Burnsbog Conservation Society. This story goes like this. Burnsbog's ecological integrity is threatened by the $7 billion Gateway Mega Development Plan, which aims to enhance the Asia-Pacific trade by expanding highways in the Greater Vancouver Regional District, as well as a threefold expansion of the port facilities of Delta Port. One of the imminent consequences of this massive initiative will be a disastrous impact on the local environment. The expansion of the highways will increase air pollution, and it will also increase climate change and greenhouse emissions. The emissions from marine vessels, whose number is expected to multiply significantly, will contribute to the emissions of smoke-forming nitrogen oxides and cancer-causing pollutants. According to the Wilderness Committee, a single container ship can emit more pollutants than 2,000 diesel trucks. Among the impacts that the expansion of Delta Port will have on the local ecosystem will be destruction of the Fraser River estuary and Roberts Bank in particular. Fraser River is the biggest salmon river in the world. Roberts Bank, situated at the mouth of Fraser River, is home to eelgrass beds, marshes, and nutrient-rich mudflats, which form an integral part of the migrating salmon habitats, the migrating birds, and the orcas. Local resident orcas, whose population has been declining, use Roberts Bank as a feeding area. Despite a warning of many scientists of the threats of the integrity of the local ecological systems, the Federal Minister of Environment has approved further development of the port. I would like to focus on Burnsbog for a bit. Burnsbog is facing a disastrous future as well, threatened by the proposed South Fraser Perimeter Road. This superhighway is supposed to cut through farmlands, wildlife habitat, and heritage communities. South Fraser Perimeter Road is supposed to connect Delta Port to Highway 1, and only 40% of the expected increase of transfer of goods will benefit the local population. According to some estimates, 241 acres of farmland will be lost, 36 acres of forest on the edges of Burnsbog will be cut, households will be displaced, at least 4 valuable archaeological sites will be destructed. And the stories go on. Among them is that of BC's government. Gateway is a government project established by the province of British Columbia back in 2003. This initiative is a response to the impact of growing regional congestion and is supposed to improve the movement of people, goods, and transit throughout Metro Vancouver. Some of the main objectives of the Gateway program are 1. To reduce congestion, which is also supposed to reduce vehicle emissions caused by idling cars. 2. To improve the region's road network. 3. To improve the quality of life in the communities by keeping regional traffic on roads instead of local streets. And 4. To reduce travel times along and across the Fraser River during peak hours. None of these seem to address the environmental impact or the concerns of the local farmers. The approval of the South Fraser Perimeter Road came through in 2008 after the Ministry of Transportation of British Columbia received an environmental assessment certificate, which was carried by a government agency. The conclusion of this assessment was that the impact of South Fraser Perimeter Road on the environment will be within reasonable limits. These results have been publicly contested ever since. The International Meyer Conservation Group has published a letter which openly criticizes the legitimacy and the accuracy of the official environment assessment. This letter states that the Burnsbog debate is based on a wrong assumption that the damage can be mitigated or compensated. In addition, the approved project is in fact in violation of a former agreement by reducing significantly the area that needs to be protected in order to save Burns Bog. As a consequence, only 82% of the area needed to preserve Burns Bog as a viable ecosystem have been protected. And there are many more stories, including those of people who will lose their homes to South Fraser Perimeter Road, those of the farmers whose lands will be destroyed, those of the ecological activists, and so on and so forth. There is one more story I would like to address in more detail. The story of Burns Bog. Why is Burns Bog so important? Well, firstly because it's a bog, and because United Nations reports have estimated that the preservation and restoration of peat bogs can reduce global greenhouse gas emissions by 10%. Peat bogs store and filter 10% of the world's fresh water. Bogs are also being exploited in an ecologically harmful way. Carbon dioxide emissions from peatland exploitation are estimated to be 3 billion tons per year. A typical peat extractor will take up to 22 centimeters of peat per year. However, it grows at approximately 1 millimeter per year. Peat bogs lock away vast amounts of carbon, which is how they control our climate. If we destroy all the peat bogs in the world, we will double the rate of global warming. An experts meeting organized by the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands and the Conservation of Biological Diversity early this year concluded that investments in conservation and restoration of peatlands can be up to 100 times more cost-effective as other carbon sequestration measures. Secondly, Burns Bog is important also because it's the largest bog in Western North America and because it's in Vancouver. Burns Bog is a regulator of local climate, since there is no drainage and all the rainfall is ultimately evaporated. It is also important for the local biotic community, as it is a home to a variety of flora and fauna, including 24 mammal and 150 bird species. Burns Bog is important because it constitutes a delicate and complex ecosystem, which forms part of a larger biome. So, Burns Bog means diversity. This means that species diversity is directly affected by abiotic factors such as temperature, moisture, and so on. Burns Bog is also important because it forms a part of a local political dispute with a significant global importance. Many different vocal and silenced agents are both directly and indirectly involved in the resolution of this dispute. We shouldn't forget that the history of Burns Bog is also the history of the native people, such as the Musqueam Indian Band. The Musqueam Indian Band is a First Nations government in British Columbia, and it's the only Indian band whose reserve community lies within the boundaries of the city of Vancouver, as probably most of you know. In June 1976, the band officially declared its right to hold Aboriginal title to the land defined by a line starting at Harvey Creek in Howe Sound and proceeding eastward. Essentially, it covers the land between Coquitlam River, Brunette River, and the south or left bank of the Fraser River. So, Burns Bog is an integral part of the cultural and historical geographical heritage of these peoples. The United Nations Environmental Programme affirms that peatlands are a crucial part of the global climate regulation system. Burns Bog Conservation Society is directing many efforts into having Burns Bog recognized as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, with the hope that the bog will be saved. Many local activist groups, among which are the Burns Bog Conservation Society and the Wilderness Committee, are putting immense efforts into saving this precious peatland. I'm not going to conclude here. Conclusions are still to be made. Much is still to be done. It's important to consider all these discourses because Burns Bog, as a crucial ecosystem, has an enormous local and global significance. The stories I share with you are only a fragment of all the Burns Bog stories out there. You certainly can get involved too and have your own voice heard, have your own Burns Bog story. Let's now hear one last one, that of Ben West from the Wilderness Committee.
So I guess I'm going to tell you a story about my experience with Burns Bog. When I first started working for the Western Canada Wilderness Committee, the campaign that I took on was the campaign to try to deal with the Gateway Project, which is a massive highway project. It involves a variety of different highways, port expansion, pipelines. It's a huge, huge project. It's so big, in fact, that when you talk to people about it, they almost talk about it as if it's synonymous with this, with progress. It's almost like the building of these highways was a force of nature in and of itself. And if anybody trying to stop this or to change where our money's being invested was really looking backward or wasn't really having a vision for the future. I really wanted to see firsthand what the impacts were. And to be honest, I'd grown up largely in urban centers. I was born in Vancouver. I grew up in Toronto, and I moved back here about 10 years ago or so, and had mostly lived in the East End of Vancouver and Kitsilano. I'd been south of the Fraser a little bit, but I didn't really know the place intimately. So as I started working on this project, I basically made it my business to get to know the area in a real tangible, hands-on kind of a way. And I should say, for the Wilderness Committee, this was a reasonably new kind of a project. The Wilderness Committee is probably best known for things like going into Clackwat Sound or, these sort of very isolated, beautiful, untouched ancient rainforests, that sort of thing. And taking on a campaign that was much more urban, and was about protecting space that really doesn't have the same sort of aesthetic or emotional sort of attachment for people, was a reasonably new thing. But I really realized, I guess, the connection between sort of more traditional Wilderness Committee campaigns and this campaign around the Gateway Project when I experienced Burns Bog firsthand. And Burns Bog, for anybody who isn't familiar with it, is the lungs of the Lower Mainland, is the way that it's described. And that was actually a name that was given to it by activists a decade or so ago when the bog was threatened by another development. In fact, there's been various development proposals in this area, largely because if you don't understand the true value of nature, you really just see it as an economic dead zone, is the way that I've heard it described. It's an area that doesn't have, big strip malls or major roads running through it. And in fact, the bog that I'm talking about is really only a small protected area, which is part of a much larger ecological system, which incorporates, all the farmland in the area, the forested region, the species that interact with it, and the Fraser River itself, and of course the Pacific Ocean and the Strait. So, to really understand Burns Bog, I think you need to see it in that light. And you really can when you get into the heart of it, because you see all of these different systems at work. You see little elements of the, that wildlife and the water that's exchanging between the Fraser River and the bog itself. And just even taking a tour there without being walked around by ecologists and scientists, which I've done, in the time since then, but just the first time I went and stepped foot on these nature trails, I wasn't really quite sure what, people were so concerned about, like why this place was so important. I understood that bogs were important, but when I got there, if you actually show up at sort of like the address for the entrance to Burns Bog, it's a parking lot. It's actually a huge ice skating rink, and there is no office for the Burns Bog Conservation Society, unfortunately. They have an administrative space, but it's not right at Burns Bog. It's somewhere else. And so you kind of get there and you realize, oh, okay, I guess I kind of walk under that highway over there, and then there's the beginning of a nature trail. And as you start walking, you're like, wow, okay, this is, a nice trail. And you get a little deeper and a little deeper. And the sort of the further you get away from the major freeway and from that parking lot that I just described, you start really experiencing this magical place. And it really is an amazing place. To call it the lungs of the Lower Mainland, I think it speaks to the role that it plays almost in sort of a biological sense. It cleans air and water, and that's important. But to really recognize sort of the value that it has, I think it's the kind of thing you can only really... You have to experience it to really understand it. I could try with words to sort of say, well, it really impacted me on a personal level, and sort of feeling that this place was a magical place, and the trees were so beautiful, and the species, it was very calming to be in a place that was so sort of disconnected from the rest of this urban landscape. But you really have to experience it to understand that. And so really, we went back to what is one of the traditional sort of strategies of the Wilderness Committee, which is you bring people to the place to help them have that same sort of connection. You know, and it's something that we try to do. I mean, we do it through videos and books and newspapers and that sort of thing, which does have an impact. I mean, it raises awareness. It gives people some sort of a picture of, you know, of what's there. And hopefully, though, what it leads to is people actually getting to the place and experiencing it. And the neat thing about the Burns Bog campaign and the campaign around the Gateway Project is, unlike trying to save Clackwat Sound, it's a lot easier to get people there. I mean, it's actually only, you know, a 20 to 40 minute drive away from where I live in Kitsilano. In fact, you know, we're sitting here at UBC right now. It's not that far from there. I mean, you can get there with, you know, even on transit, it doesn't take very long, about an hour to get from here to there. And all of a sudden you're so far removed from the urban landscape that it's hard to even describe. You know, so it was really that experience, I think, that made me at a real personal level feel like a need to protect this place. Not just you know, for my own experience, but just because it felt wrong that something was being done that could harm it. It felt as wrong as watching somebody kick a kitten or something. You know, like to see a place that really is thriving and alive in and of itself, and to see it in danger is a very frustrating thing, and it's the kind of thing that motivates people to action.
Thanks to Lisa Rodina for that special coverage. In more local news, we bring you an update about a special report we brought to you on Friday's show. As our broadcast is at 5 p.m., we were not able to bring you news about a demonstration that took place at the Michael Ignatieff Town Hall meeting that occurred in the Student Union building Friday afternoon. Here's what happened.
Before this demonstration started, that one of the key things about politics, one of the key things about Canada, is we can't pick and choose which facts we like. The tar sands are a fact of our national life. We have one of the largest proven carbon reserves, oil reserves in the world. The question is, what do we do to make it sustainable, right? I think I've got it here, right? What do we do to make this industry sustainable? I've made it very clear that we need to have tough federal regulation, a cap and trade system that gets emissions absolutely down. But if you're asking me to shut down the tar sands, it's not in my power to do so, and I'll tell you frankly, it is not in the national interest of our country to do that.
This is Ian Turner. Joining me here is Andrew Longhurst to discuss the protest.
So, Ian, you were at the event. Can you describe to me the protest itself?
Yeah. A lady from Greenpeace stood up and asked a question to Michael Ignatieff. And before she gave him an opportunity to respond, she started chanting, "Shut down the tar sands." And at that point, two people who were seated behind Michael Ignatieff got up with posters, unraveled them, and three people in the front of the orchestra also got up and unraveled their own posters. And at that point, it just degenerated into a loud shouting match between liberal supporters and the Greenpeace. And it didn't take long until the liberal crowd was definitely much louder than the Greenpeace crowd. And eventually, Michael Ignatieff did respond to the question.
Was there any attempt by security personnel at the event to pull them off the stage or to take the mics away from them?
It was very surprising. When Michael Ignatieff came in, I could not see any security detail with him. He was only accompanied by his wife and what appeared to be a campaign manager. And Michael himself actually was the one who tried to defuse the situation. There was no one from the Liberals stood up to help him.
Earlier during the question and answer period, Michael Ignatieff declined to commit to signing on to the Kyoto Plus petition, which would commit to quite measurable greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets. Do you think that was that issue, not specifically at the Q&A, but because in the past he has declined to sign that, do you think that was a reason why he was targeted?
Yeah, I mean, I think Michael Ignatieff, he opened up by saying that we were very cynical, the youth were very cynical about politics, and part of it was that politicians were saying one thing and doing another thing, and it's impossible really to make the tar sand sustainable. He said he would make them sustainable, and he didn't commit to Kyoto Plus because he knows there's no way to make them sustainable, and so he dodged the question, and that's why students were very frustrated with him.
Great. Well, thanks for the commentary on that. I appreciate that, and glad you were there to catch that for us.
Thank you, Andrew. It's now time for the Arts Report. And for that, we turn to arts reporter Nick Panu for a special report on Fortune Film Festival. Nick brings us an interview with Ira Cooper and Angela Acosta.
Right now, we're outside the Rio Theater with the franchise, Angel Acosta.
Hello.
And the face for Fortunato Films, Ira Cooper.
Hi.
Some of the actors outside the Rio Theater for Fortunato Films Film Festival Extravaganza, raising money for Global Agents for Change, Saturday matinee. How's this experience for you, your first film festival for your company, Fortunato Films?
I'll let Ira take this one. It was like my first time. It was awkward. It was dark. She was older. I was sober. No, it was good. It's tough. It's really tough, man, to promote arts. Look, if I had Heath Ledger in my film, then people would see it just because they felt bad. But nobody feels bad for me. Maybe I should just die or something, and then people would, or at least pretend, like Tupac. I know you're out there, Tupac. But yeah, it's tough. It's tough.
Again, some boos and hisses maybe among the listeners. I don't want to make this too personal, but I almost, you know, from our past interviews and the festivals when you've gotten up there in the Q&A and talked, you offended me sometimes when I came here because it's for a good cause, raise money for Global Agents for Change. And not only that, the quality of films that Fortunato Film puts out there. One of the films, best script for the Bloodshots Film Competition, Goodfellas will screen the full cuts tonight. You have the burlesque dancers.
Sundown to Sunset. Sundown to Sunset Cabaret. We had Elliot, the comedian. Let me tell you, we went the mile. We even went the 8 mile. R.I.P. Brittany Murphy.
I just met Elliot today, and I find him hilarious.
Yeah, Elliot Chan was is very, very funny. In your films, the premise is not...
Thank you so much.
This is Joel Libin. He has an art gallery. Where is that art gallery? This is for a radio.
It's at 1011 Main Street on the west side of the street. It's called Basic Inquiry Gallery. It's a Vancouver Life Drawing Studio.
Actually, your painting was sold today.
Yeah, it's good because it goes for a good donation for the global initiative for the change there and that. So I'm for that. That's good.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, it's very admirable that you're able to come down and give your painting away for a very good cause.
Yeah, it seems like a good cause, and I was going on a bike ride for a good cause. That's how I found out about it, and yeah, I don't know. Good things can come, and it's just, I'm glad I had artwork to donate. Yeah. I'll see you later.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
You as well.
You talked about the inappropriateness of our film. The thing is, you've got people who are in politics, and you've got people all around the world who are in charge of countries, and we make little films that are offensive, but they actually do real things that are really, really, really offensive, that are actually acts and not just words. So, in a sense, our films are kind of the microcosm of that, saying, hey, you guys are offended by this, maybe you guys should be offended by actually important things rather than me making jokes about... What I'm saying is that there are present-day problems, and that we can't hide them, we can't hide in past events. It's kind of like Brecht, Bertolt Brecht, who did a play called Mother Curse and Her Children. He was talking about a war that had passed long, long time ago, but he was actually talking about a modern day war. He placed it a long time ago because he was embarrassed. But we should really just focus on things that are here right now in our city. Really, look around you. There's problems in our city. See, people aren't, they don't want to smile. There's one thing that's a problem.
We're midway through January, almost midway through, and the cuts are imminent, the arts cuts. So is this the kind of initiative that the arts community, the filmmakers have to take to keep doing what we want to do?
Yes, Angel, do you have anything to say?
I agree. I think a friend of mine said, she said that we're doers, and then that is... it's good. I mean, that's what we do. We do. We may not do it right or correctly, or we're politically incorrect, or whatever. We're just doing what we like, and we're doing it, and no one else is, so why not? This is fun. There's going to be cops coming, apparently, going to arrest Ira. All these films are good. Everyone had a good time. Everyone ate, drank. It's a celebration, not just our films, but of other people's, and... I wouldn't mind doing it again another year, next year, when we'll have to do a lot more films, I guess, but...
Make more!
We'll have to make more.
I'll help you.
What we need to do is start supporting our local guys, because they're starving, eh? You know, arts is actually very important. I mean, what do you do on the weekend? You go see a film, you go to the ballet, you go to the opera, you go, we're not all going to the Olympics. I mean, so during that period of time, we're going to need films. We're going to need...
Should people, the listeners, always check the listings for places such as the Rio? And are there other venues that regularly feature independent films, shortened features?
Yeah, the Rio is awesome. I'm doing an interview now. You guys are awesome. You in the booth. You are awesome. Thank you so much. It was really economically sound to be part of it. They were really good. Other venues that are really good is District 319. I don't know how cheap they are, but they have terracotta soldiers, so they must be awesome. There's a bunch of us. The one thing we got to stop doing is we can't be cliquey. We got to kind of share our love. This was this whole film festival thing. Everyone got to show their little piece of film.
Ira, Angel, all the money, the ticket sales from your event, your film festival, goes for Global Agents for Change. And you're biking, Ira, next year, this summer, for Global Agents for Change.
Yes, I am. I'm riding from Amsterdam to Istanbul, but it's not really, I say a lot of eyes, but the whole thing is I really feel that we need to push things like this. And I said this before, and I was long-winded before, so I'm going to make it short-winded. We need to do something. We need to actually make changes. We can't just sit on our asses and watch things happen. Standing in front of the art gallery and yelling at the art gallery isn't going to do it. We need to do something. I mean, I agree. Write your MLA. Write your MLA. Go out and make films that make people see this. That shows that. We need to go beyond just yelling and screaming and being angry and finding out what happened. I mean, this morning, 5 in the morning, I yelled at my hard drive to work, and nothing happened. It just sat there. But I had to think beyond the yelling point. I had to, show whatever I could, do whatever I could. I don't know where this is going, but yeah.
We're just speaking to the franchise for Fortunato Films.
Angel.
And the face, the man, a lot of times, not always, but is known for creating controversy.
Trevor Brown.
Oh, Trevor Brown wasn't here tonight. You know, Trevor Brown.
He was playing basketball.
Not even kidding.
Outside the real theater for Fortunato Films Film Festival extravaganza to raise money for Global Agents for Change.
Thank you. I don't know if anyone said that to you, but thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Hey, buddy. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
I'm out.
Thanks to Nick Panu for that special report. You can catch the full art report Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. night here at CITR 101.9 FM. And that's our program for January 18th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news at citr.ca. Brad Pepnick produced this radio show. For more news, join us on Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Ian Turner from the news team at CITR. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for this side of Monday right here on 101.9 FM CITR.